Today we complete a year in our considerations of a very, very important topic. We started last year on the 24th of May with the Friday group. Briefly, the topic was this: the Buddha visits his three great disciples who are in retreat, practicing the discipline, Anuruddha, Nandiya and Kimbila. And after exchanging the compliments and greetings of politeness and courtesy, as is always so charmingly put in the discourses, the Buddha inquires whether they were living together on friendly terms and harmoniously, like milk and water blending, regarding each other with the eye of affection. And they each answer in turn, Anuruddha first, he being the elder, and he says that yes, they did live on such friendly and harmonious terms. And the Buddha inquires, how is it that you managed to live so? And the important point that Anuruddha brings out is, and therefore, Lord, surrendering my mind, we live on friendly and harmonious terms, like milk and water blending. Note that very carefully, because milk and water once blended cannot be separated. You have mixed them and you cannot separate them. At least as far as I know, we don't know any chemistry which will once again extract the pure milk and separate it from the water. So that was the important point, surrendering his mind. And we've spent this whole year around that topic. Sometimes it seems as if we have digressed very far from it, but we haven't really. Throughout the year, all our meetings have been directed, as far as I could possibly do so, towards that central topic. Living on friendly terms harmoniously, regarding each other with the eye of affection, and we may add, of our own accord, we may add, not only regarding each other with the eye of affection, but listening with the ear of understanding. This matter is of the utmost importance. I need not dilate upon it. The world's supreme shortage is, as it always has been, love in its reality, not in its ephemeral, illusory form, which is one of the poles of the duality, of the ambivalent love-hate that we ordinarily know. It's not that. This is something transcendent. And if this transcendent reality can somehow or other come into the lives of human beings and function easily and freely, I do not doubt that quite 99% or more of the world's problems would vanish. It is very significant that the great teachers of Hinduism, Buddhism, Jesus Christ, Krishnamurti today, they emphasize above all things this thing which is love in its transcendent aspect. None of its neurotic manifestations, its absurd manifestations, but the transcendent reality. And you remember, some weeks ago, we considered this matter of the significance of the fact that concerned with the problem of human suffering, all the great teachers gave not an answer on a human level, on our, the, what that is to say, what we commonly call a human level, a material, a psychological level, but gave only the transcendent answer and no other. They did not suggest any welfare state, any economic scheme, any educational method, or anything like that at all. Nothing at our ordinary level. Our ordinary level of desirous observation and thinking and acting. It is extremely significant. The forms in which they presented the great teaching of love sometimes seems obvious to us, but their real significance and their depth has eluded us throughout the centuries. The simple proof of that is that love takes very much a back seat in human history. Very much a back seat. Now, during this year then, to what extent have we been able to realize, even at rare moments, something of that transcendent reality? Are we free of hate, resentment, anger? The reactions due to frustrated desire, above all, frustrated longings, are we free? There is no use talking about nirvana, enlightenment, the kingdom of heaven, or serving God or man or anything like that in a manner which seems to indicate that we know something about it. We don't. We haven't the slightest realization of the kingdom of heaven or nirvana or God or anything at all. Because there is something which stands in the way. If that thing didn't stand in the way, the fountains of compassion would flow freely throughout the world. And the world's face would not be a tearful face, a drawn, haggard, lined face. It's a very interesting fact. It's a very interesting thing that both Zarathustrianism and Hinduism have presented this pictorially, mythologically, in identical terms. Zarathustrianism presents this in this manner. The soul of the cow wailed unto the Lord, complaining of the wrath, insolence, rapine, cruelty, oppression upon her throughout the earth, and asked for the deliverer. And the conception of the deliverer, curiously enough, is very much like the Mosaic conception. The man of power would come with the sword and establish by force righteousness on earth and peace. And when the response comes from heaven that there is only one Zarathustra, the earth is bitterly disappointed. What? This man who just mumbles prayers and so forth, and not a great warrior? And then, as the Gathas go on, there is the reconciliation, and the earth is willing to accept Zarathustra, and then the story unfolds like that. That's one example. And in the Bhagavata Purana, which together with the Vishnu Purana are the two most important Puranas of Hinduism. Incidentally, the Puranas are the mythological form in which Hinduism is presented, somewhat like Greek mythology. Just as you have the tales of the gods and all the rest of it in Greek mythology, so too you have them in Hindu mythology, in the Puranas. The goddesses play a somewhat smaller part, less in quantity, in the Hindu Puranas than the goddesses do in Greek mythology, as far as I'm aware. Now, in the Bhagavata Purana, I think it comes in the very first chapter, there is the account of the earth in the shape of a cow, with tears streaming down her eyes, piteously lowing, complained to the Lord of the oppression, the cruelty, the insolence, the wrath, etc., which she had to suffer. See, it's put in this form. The cow, again, and as you know, for the ancient peoples, the cow represented the entire feminine aspect of all existence, also the supporter, the nourisher, the one that endures patiently always, the cow. You see, the cow piteously lowing. And then it goes on very beautifully, Brahma, the Father God, thereupon goes into meditation, and then in a state of super consciousness speaks to Vishnu, the second person of the Trinity. This is quite interesting where the differences come in. The Hindu stuff is very very beautifully developed. It's absolutely perfectly expressed. You have to read it and meditate on it for months, and you get the whole significance of it emerging gradually, and all that happens. If you merely read it as so many words, you'd say, oh, these people and their imagination. Some of it seems so absurd and so backward, primitive, but it's really perfect psychology, you see. All right, so there we are. Now that's how it has been put. And it is love which has been lacking. Zarathustra comes as the champion of righteousness. He is the embodiment of loving devotion unto Ahura Mazda. That is how Zarathustra is presented. And I think that Zarathustrian teaching is the earliest, apart from the Upanishads, which presents the duality of the mind. The mind is presented as composed of two aspects. The evil twin, it's presented as twins. The evil twin, Akemmano, evil mind, and Spaintomano, the good mind. See, these twins are in each and every one of us. And to each and every one of on the shoulders of each and every one of us rests the responsibility to choose which twin he will serve. At the end, in the final consummation, Akemmano is redeemed by the good twin, you see, and they both become one with the Lord in the underworld. It's one of the extremely significant teachings which you find. You find the same in the Subala Upanishad, that in the end, Mrityu, death, the Lord of death, becomes one with the Lord. He is the last one to become one with the Lord. Significant, isn't it? Death. But now, this, and the that was the response in Zarathustrianism. In the Hindu teaching, the response is the birth of Sri Krishna. And Sri Krishna is essentially the Lord of love. Secondarily, we say, the love aspect is not emphasized very much in the actual writings as such, but it is there, most definitely. And perhaps for the first time in Brahmanical and Hindu teachings, you get the presentation of the personal Lord incarnate in Sri Krishna, saying to his disciple, "Thou art beloved of me. Come unto me, I will liberate you from your sins." That comes in the 18th discourse at the very end. But you see how that aspect of love comes to fruition ultimately. And of course, throughout the Buddhist teachings, metta, karuna, and so on are stressed in almost every other discourse. So we have this teaching very, very powerfully emphasized in all the great religions of the world. But now, where are we? We ourselves, each one of us. For some weeks, we have been considering this very important aspect of this core of sorrow inside us. This repressed sorrow. Born of the frustration of desire. Natural desires, legitimate desires, one may say, and certainly so, psychologically speaking. At the psychophysical level, they are perfectly normal, natural, good desires, but their frustration produces inside us this poisonous core of sorrow. We can't make a frontal attack upon it. We can't perform a surgical operation upon it. It is not something we can throw away. We can never perform a surgical operation psychologically. Psychologically, supposing we had, we used physical terms, we had a diseased psychological kidney or liver or heart or something, you cannot extirpate it. You cannot effect a transplant. What actually happens is that that diseased psychical liver is transformed into a perfectly healthy psychical liver, and that's that. With the psyche, it is like that. And you remember we considered the roots from which this springs, and to what aspects it is related. Aversion, fear, the passion to assert the self, our lust, the frustrated ambitions with respect to career, one's work in life, one's ambitions and all the rest of it. And above all, the pain of unrequited love. The pain of love that has been lost through death, through whatever the causes may be, through betrayal, through treachery. And so there is this bottled up hate, anger, resentment, and a sense of hopelessness. One can't do a thing about it. So one just endures and endures, waiting till the end comes. The circumstance holds one in, imprisons one. You can't get away from it. There are duties, there are responsibilities. It is impossible to break free circumstantially. And if we have understanding and insight, we will see that psychologically it is impossible to break free. We must appreciate the tremendous importance of this fact, that whatsoever dis-ease there is in the psyche, that part of the psyche has to be transformed into the healthy psyche. We must never forget that our psychical energy is the mental counterpart of the electrochemical energy of the body. That is all. You can extirpate the ill of the psyche only by extirpating the body. And then there is no you. That's the end. There is no problem one way or the other. We must appreciate that point very much, fully, because the human task is to deal with this very problem. This is the individual human task. We can be assisted by not only people, but everything around us. But that assistance, which in fact is always coming to us, is prevented because we don't use our senses rightly. How do we use our senses? If I look at this object, or if I look at any of you, how do I look? With what eyes? Are my eyes just looking? Just purely seeing? Or is there a Mephistopheles, the embodiment of desire, who is looking through these eyes? Desire. How do I look when I see a pretty little piece of fluff passing by? How do I look at a person who gives me the impression, here's an intelligent fellow, I can use him for this, that and the other purpose, organize my lectures or this, that and the other, or type out my book for me, etc., etc. It's all for the cause, you know, it's all for the cause. And therefore, for this mythical cause, the living being is sacrificed. Absolutely, ruthlessly sacrificed. So what I see is a mechanism to satisfy my lust. Nothing else. I don't see a living being. The living being is the transcendent embodied. The face of the transcendent shines through the face of my brother man. All the time, whatever that face may be. But I don't see it. I'm blind. And I'm blinded by desire. I look with desire. How do I look at an object? For its utility, from fulfilling my purposes, my desires, or with complete indifference, as if it was not there. Doesn't this little stool exist in its own rights? A harmless little thing never harms me unless I'm stupid enough to stumble over it. But how do I look at it? Stool for my use, my purposes. Of course a stool has usefulness. But do I ever use it? Asking its permission to use it, by its leave. Or am I the oppressive tyrant? Thou shalt do this, that, and the other for me, stool. I take a spoon and a fork. How do I use it when I eat? How do I dust that piano when the group is about to come? Oh, blast this thing, all this. All this dust, get rid of it quickly. I curse the dust and curse the piano and all the rest of it. But you see, I'm looking at that dust on the piano with desire, with my eyes aflame with desire. With oppressive, egoistic self-assertion. This is how I look. This is how I use my eye. How can I regard you? How can I regard this carpet, this ceiling, these flowers, anything with the eye of affection? When I don't regard things are a very good example, more so than human beings. When I regard things critically without the eye of affection, then I say to myself, oh, that ugly book, it should be bound, or I must get rid of it, and it all looks so ugly and horrid and all the rest of it. I'm looking at it with hate emanating from me. But if I regarded that book over there with the eye of affection, I will see it wants attention, it wants healing, it wants making beautiful, making whole. That's a very different thing, isn't it? See, this being, this person then, is emanating love, not hate. Between him and that object, there is a living relationship of beauty and love. Instead of this cruel barrier, somebody in the home is so tiresome, has got such an offhand manner, etc., etc., etc. Somebody in the office is so this, that, and the other. The school building is so awful, all the cloakrooms are antediluvian, there's no hot water, there is this, that and the other, the playgrounds wrong, the laboratories are horribly out of date, etc., etc., etc. All the time I'm hating. If the guardian spirits of the world had an ethereal camera and they took a photograph of me, or shall we say a film of me throughout the day, I think they would get bankrupt trying to persuade anybody to come and see that ugly film. And when we deceive ourselves that we are looking with the eye of affection or listening with the ear of understanding, is it the reality of love, or is it this possessive emotion? And a possessive emotion will always dominate. If a man meets that kind of simpering girl who falls in love with him and weaves a little web to entrap him, that little simpering type is the one who is the most oppressively possessive. And vice versa, to just change the sexes and use the right characteristics, and you have the story. Domination. Possession. How do I regard religion? As the tool for my pleasure, for my salvation, to save me from my fear. Can I love my God? Can I love my fellow man? And all the time, basically, because I look, I hear, I touch, I taste, I smell with desire dominating that looking, touching, hearing. Desire dominant all along the line. We believe we love our children, our own children, or our parents, or our friends. Sometimes it's much easier between friends. Between close relatives, sometimes it's much more difficult. But take those cases where, say, the love of parent and child is a really wonderful thing, as far as human beings can see. Look at it carefully. Is the dearly beloved one really loved or considerably possessed? You know, there's a tremendously difficult psychology involved in this. When the little child suffers, the parent suffers terribly. Look carefully into the suffering of that parent. Is it because my pleasure in the child has been upset by the parents, by the child's suffering? Is it that my anxiety has been touched very deeply and I am fearful? Oh, what will happen? But it is I who am anxious. Look at a child who falls ill with a serious illness. Many a child just doesn't care two hoots about it. Goes through frightful illnesses without the slightest fear. It has a sort of a... The confidence of ignorance that nothing will happen to it, that it will, of course, tomorrow, day after, get out of that sick bed. But the parent, oh, it might die. I will lose that child. My position will go. My pleasure will be hurt. Isn't there that element? Or is there? I'm not telling you it is so. You sort of consider it quietly, with the mind quiet, and see how my desire is wrapped up with everything. Now, do we begin to get a glimpse of why the Buddha asserted unequivocally that the cause of all dukkha, without exception, is tanha? Desire, intense desire, longing. Let us look again for a few moments. We did this before too, but let us look again at dukkha, the ill state. It has, we all know it in the ordinary, commonplace, psychological sense, that I am in misery, grief, sorrow, pain, confusion, distraction, and all the rest of it. This is my dukkha. That I am, I have to make ends meet with tuppence halfpenny a week, which is impossible, and so forth and so forth. All right, we know all that dukkha. That I've got a thundering headache and so forth. Well, we know all that. But look at dukkha in the ontological context, so to say. The universal context. Buddhism presents the five khandhas, the five heaps, as it calls it. Everything that we as we are apprehend. Everything. Body, mind, consciousness, everything. As dukkha. What we call the good and the bad, the pleasant and the painful, the sublime and the sullied, all of it, said the Buddha, is dukkha. And remember, we considered this rather carefully. The meaning of dukkha, dukkha. The infinite, the infinite spoilt, made bad, do. Or extracted out of. We, in the dualistic sense, in our ordinary ambivalent way, we talk of sukha, happiness, as the opposite of dukkha, pain. But you see, both dukkha and sukha are transcended in terms of kha. That sounds like a letter of the alphabet. It is, and it is also a whole word, which represents the infinite, the absolute, the unborn, the unaging, the undying, the unsorrowing. It represents the transcendent. So you see, the transcendent takes us completely out of the sphere of both dukkha and sukha. Take it in the Upanishadic way. The Atma, Brahman, are presented as the unborn, the unaging, the undying, etc. The Atma or Brahman becomes this all. This all, the total universe of manifestation, exists. And you remember we considered this word existence, ex, out of, and sistere, to stand out of, to be an appearance of. So the total manifested universe is something that stands out of the transcendent, unborn, unaging, undying, the unformed, the unmade, the unbecome, and so forth. It stands out of it, and it is dependent on it. But the transcendent is independent of the universe. See, Christian theology is quite right there, the way they present it, that the universe is contingent upon God. God is not dependent upon the universe. All right. So that which is an appearance of, and now is subject to beginning, process, and ending, therefore subject to mortality, subject to death, is dukkha. You see, the extraordinary emphasis that you find, particularly in Buddhism, all along the line, this is impermanent, meaning that this is the dying. You see? Well, of course we all know that a fellow who is born must die and all the rest of it, and a great many of us, when death comes, will be die like gentlemen and gentlewomen, in proper English fashion, you see? We all do that, so what? What's all this fuss that the Buddha is making? But consider the meaning of dying, the significance of death in this ontological context, that it is not the transcendent, that it is not the perfect. Now what made this appearance stand out? That much we know. We don't know how it affected the standing out, but we know what made it stand out. The Buddha's answer is the same answer put in rather a different form in the teachings of Hermes Trismegistus, and it is the same answer which you find in Hinduism too. And it is the implied answer, it is the implied answer in the Old Testament. The answer is tanha. Desire. Therefore, good desires and evil desires in the psychological context, in this ambivalent sphere which is our ordinary life, alike, good desires and evil desires alike are productive of dukkha. When I look at that object with a good desire in the ambivalent sense, in the psychological sphere, all right, in terms of worldliness, it will certainly produce good results. That is true, according to worldly values. But if you and I are interested and are concerned with religion, which is concerned with the transcendent, then the good desires as well, we have to be free of bondage to the good desires also. See, in the Upanishads, for instance, they say again and again that having worked out the results, the pleasant results of his good desires, he comes back to this state. Again and again. You are once more in the conflict. You see, we don't ever really go deeply into this. Some people do, but in a sort of scholarly fashion. Well, the scholarship part is necessary, but that's the kindergarten stage. The greatest of the scholars, insofar as they confine themselves to the scholarly treatment of doctrines, are purely in the kindergarten stage. They still like playing with their sand castles on the seashore. No, we have to so meditate upon this that, at last you really see it. And when you really see it, that will be the beginning of the understanding of desire and the power of desire. Now look. We, in our ordinary, confused, suffering human stage, are under the domination of anteros. We transform anteros into eros. Eros is called, he is not only the child of some of the gods and goddesses, or one god and one goddess, but he is also presented as the parent of all the gods and the conferrer of immortality upon all the gods. The gods are the great archetypal forms, the great controlling forces, so to say, or shall we say the forces which indicate the trend of universal process and evolution. It's the same in the Hindu teaching. Kama, the god of desire, Kama, is on the one hand the child, and he is also the parent of all the gods and the one who confers immortality upon them. It was only last week, I think, that at last it dawned upon me why in that 10th book of the Rig Veda, in the famous creation hymn number 129, there are two creation hymns in the 10th book, special ones, but this 129 is the great one. Why in the third verse there is this statement? First of all, it starts off with a statement of the absolute, the infinite, you see. And then thereafter arose karma. And out of the activity of karma proceeded this all. See, now karma is eros there. Now, eros is the pure form of what eros and anteros represent together. It's the pure form. That is why the manifested world as world is in itself good. And God made this, and saw that it was good. Not that it was bad. And then Father Adam came along and something went wrong after Mrs. came along.
I wasn't responsible.
No, I know you were. That's why I could look at you without any accusation. But please remember, I'm not God. You see, the world in itself is good. If that were not the case, it would be impossible for the restoration, the rebuilding, the replacing of that which is under the domination of the Lord of Death into the transcendent realm. The return path would be impossible. Is this rather too difficult, or are you following it?
Yes.
You follow it. Good. You see, this is why the so-called pantheistic doctrine, against which all theistic religions rebel rather strongly, and all theistic mystics and saints and philosophers are rather terrified, because if you accept the pantheistic doctrine, you simply cannot solve the problem of evil. They forget that in any case the problem of evil as such can never be solved at the human level. It's totally impossible. It can't be solved, you see. But the pantheistic presentation, if really understood, the Upanishadic presentation, that all this is itself Brahman Atma. You see? Then you will see that because all this essentially is the good, although it manifests ephemerally as being under the domination of death, the sphere of mortality, the sphere of conflict, pain, confusion, sorrow, and all the rest of it. In spite of that, the return to the ultimate reality is possible. But you see, that would be tantamount, in the ordinary logical, philosophical sphere, to saying that evil is good. But if you really understand it, you will see that that is the case. How? Consider again what we said about the psyche. The evil in the psyche cannot be extirpated. It has to be transformed into the good. So evil in our human sphere, the dualistic sphere, serves this remarkably wonderful purpose of being the stimulus, the challenge, which makes the other side of us interact with it and enables us through this ingoing development in terms of our own inner consciousness to transcend the conflict of opposites whilst living in the world of the opposites. So now let's come back to desire, the nature of desire. The teaching which is so ill expressed in several of the religious formulations, the verbal formulations of the religions. Kill out desire. Control your desire. These are inadequate, misleading formulations. You cannot kill out desire. If you want to kill the desire or fool yourself into thinking you can kill desire, commit suicide. Can't kill desire. Transform it. And how does one transform it? By allowing it to transform itself. This is a psychical energy. This thing, desire, is a psychical energy. Now, the operation of this psychical energy, which is within the living person, is dependent upon, and it is related to, external stimuli all the time. If I use my eyes, I look with the eyes of desire, as I said, you see. And that is why I can't look with the eye of affection. I look with the eye of desire. But there must be something to look at. That has to be the stimulus. The lovely Steinway piano, or the pretty little piece of fluff, or the marvelous whatever it is, or the advertisement which I'm looking at, etc., etc., etc. There has to be the stimulus. Then this psychical activity of desire springs up. And because I am unmindful, unawake, ignorant, caught up in the mechanism of process which I don't understand, either within myself or in connection with myself in relationship to what is commonly called the not-self, because of all that, one is in the mire. As the Buddha put it very simply, burning with the fires of lust, hate, delusion. All the khandhas are burning with the fires of lust, hate, and delusion. See, this so-called pessimistic presentation of Buddhism, and Christianity too is accused of being a pessimistic, life-denying religion. This is why I think, one of the reasons why I think so little of the sort of stuff that Albert Schweitzer and those like him have presented. People like Schweitzer should stick to their organ playing and to their hospitals. That's their proper place. Let the shoemaker stick to his last. A very, very wise proverb. Or what is it? Is it a proverb or a saying? Anyway. You see? So now, it's the mindfulness which is my task, my responsibility. As Krishnamurti says, just watch, pay attention. Passive alertness. Not doing anything about it. The Upanishads gave practically no instruction how you tackle your desire. They gave no instruction as such. The one thing they kept repeating ad nauseam was just remain aware of the fact that thou art Brahman. Well, of course, we get a good many instances of people, especially in India, who quite openly and quite charmingly and sweetly tell you, I am Brahman, you know, and just like that. I know one very dear person, better not mention his name, he flourishes in on the western coast of southern India. And I don't know whether he's alive still, he's pretty well on in years. And this is what he says, you know, I am Brahman, I am the Supreme Being. Everything that happens in the world and around happens because I let it happen. If I were to say no, or this, that, other, it would stop. It's a good thing there are so many other half-wits who keep him fed, otherwise he can't cook his meals even for himself. Poor old Brahman, unable to feed himself.
Oh, it's harmless, isn't it?
So see, that is all that the Upanishads put. But the Upanishads put that simply because there was no writing in those days. It was handed over by word of mouth, and only the sort of shorthand notes of the essential points, so to say, were handed over like that. They formed the collection. That is why passage after passage of the Upanishads just reads like gibberish. One doesn't know what it means. It's very difficult to interpret a great many passages of the Upanishads. There are certain other things which we should note carefully. When I look at a person or an object, and I'm looking with desire, looking through my eyes, you see, that desire has become a sort of habit also. It is not altogether a fresh, new desire. It has become a stereotyped habit. You see? The leer of lust with which that type of man looks at a woman, you see, has become a habit with him. There is no juice behind his feeling. He's just a flop, actually. When we look at a thing with this desire aspect operating, look at an object. With regard to so many objects, this desire has just become a habit. We are caught in that mechanism. This is one of the meanings of saying we are in bondage. It is literally a bondage, a bond. It's a compulsion. You see? Now the thing is that one must awaken to this fact. Take the pleasant aspect. If I look at those flowers, they are so beautiful, aren't they? Now, in the ordinary way, what happens when I look as a human being? Oh, aren't those tulips lovely, wonderful? But have I looked into what is implied in this reaction of my psyche, this enthusiastic reaction of my psyche, what is implied in the psyche itself? It is indulging in pleasure. And it is grasping at it. It is wanting it all the time. And when I look at a person or an object and there is the opposite feeling, pain, sorrow inside it, it is because there is aversion present there. There is hate. A person is capable of hurting me and hurting my feelings because I am hating at that moment of feeling hurt. I have an aversion. I don't want that person to do this to me. I wish it to be otherwise. Why do I wish it to be otherwise? Why am I so unself-contained, incomplete, inadequate in myself, that I should wish another to be other than what he is? He exists in his own right. Now you see why between man and man, man and woman, love is such a rarity. In its transcendent, in its utter purity, in its real marvel. But you know, if you know this, first of all, to start with, of course, obviously with the mind, with the brain, one has to know it. All right. You know it with the brain. And when that knowing with the brain has gone in, penetrated the first layer of molecules of the brain cells, you see, the first layer of the brain cells and gone to the second and third layers underneath, you see, when it has become that sort of thing, then the knowing becomes so powerful that it enables you to be awake, to be wary. Not wary in the sense of protection against something, but to be capable of looking and knowing what you're looking at and what your mode of looking is. Then you know it. See? You're awake to it. Then you will find that whatever desire element is there begins to disappear. This you must really practice, you know. Really practice with tremendous wide awake consciousness. Be really alive to it and practice it. Again and again, all through the day, because all through the day our senses are operating. The eyes are operating all the day, all along. All through the day whilst you are awake and your eyes are open. They stop operating, of course, when you're asleep. All right. You see? Practice this. And you know what will happen? At those wonderful, wonderful occasions, when you are free inside, there is no desire looking out, then the whole caboodle of greed and hate are absent also, if no desire is looking out. You see, suddenly you will see transcendent beauty. The beauty which is utterly independent of form, shape, color, attractiveness, or whatever it is. It's independent of it. In other words, you will be conscious in transcendent terms. That consciousness which the Buddha spoke of, for instance, as vijnanam anidassanam, attributeless. That is its first meaning, attributeless. Dr. Konza has translated it as infinite. You see? Anidassanam, anantam, without end. If it's without end, it had no beginning. Therefore, immeasurable. Sabbato babam, babam, shining everywhere. If one really appreciates and understands this, one will see where Jung has not succeeded really in getting at the very heart of the Indian teachings. There are passages in his introductory commentaries to those Tibetan books, you know, which Evans Wentz has translated, which just give that little bit away. He hasn't got it. He makes the wrong equations, the collective unconscious and the personal unconscious. However, that is not very important. So that is the awareness which you will have. This is a fact. You won't read this anywhere, as far as I know. But I have seen this. And you will find that the person, the object, which has been the source of pain, or sorrow, or conflict, or trouble, or the source of pleasure, of satisfaction, of great calm, gratification, a sense of, there's a good job done, my duty has been done, the children are getting on lovelily in life, and all that vanishes, and something utterly new happens. The child is no longer the child, the friend is no longer the friend, the parent is not the parent, the enemy is not the enemy. The pig is not the pig, the dog is not the dog, the rose is not the rose. It is that eternal, indescribable which is there. And rooted in that, this thing, because this has emerged out of that immortal, is the representative, the living representative of that thing. And it is a non-sensational experience. It is without emotion, it is without thought, it is without any sort of knowledge. It is the state of communion, which is the very heart of religion.
Could you tell us again what it is we should practice?
Use your eyes, your ears, your sense of touch, without desire. You can't do it now. Therefore, be awake to the activity of that desire. Watch, be mindful of the action of that desire. You see? Knowing it is, don't do anything against the desire. Don't fight with your desire, because then your right hand is fighting with your left hand. And you can fool yourself like that for the next 300,000 billion years. You see? Don't fight it. Just look. And in that looking, you perform the miracle of healing, the transmutation. You heal the blind one yourself. You heal the deaf one. You, the lame one, walks. One of the deep meanings of the miracles of Jesus. You see, in the Atharva Veda, the identical thing is put about the blind see, the lame walks, etc. The Atharva Veda is the date ascribed to it when the whole collection was first put together. All the hymns were made into a definite collection. It's approximately 1000 BC. Practice when you want to, we can practice this all day as we go through the day. But there are occasions when we are, as we commonly say, doing nothing. It's our leisure time. You're sitting in here, you've come home from work, you're tired, and you are sort of going off in a slightly somnolent condition. Well, if you go off to sleep, all right, so much the better. Sleep and wake up refreshed. But if you are not actually in the condition to fall asleep, then do it in two ways. Call to mind that which is pleasant and regard it with your mental eye. Your son, your sweetheart, your friend, your whoever it is, the big bad boss in the office, or whoever it is, you see, call to mind the pleasant thing. Then do it also with whatsoever is unpleasant. With the pleasant thing, it will be possessive desire. Sensuous, pleasantly sensuous desire. With the unpleasant thing or person with whom you are at loggerheads, it will be desire as hate, as aversion functioning. And in that intensity of looking, quiet intensity, this is the difficult part of the story. A completely quiet intensity. It is like telling a fellow, put forth your utmost muscular effort without flexing your muscles. He's asking him to do the impossible. You see? But psychically it can be done. This is the astonishing part of it. That is why everybody can enter the kingdom of heaven, if he will. See? So do it with regard to the unpleasant. And maybe, mind you, do it without expectations. Don't expect all the wonderful things that I've been hot airing about just now, you see? Just watch. See if an extraordinary peace doesn't come, just well out from you. And you will realize then, actually realize here now, that sublime state the Buddha talked of in the Brahma Viharas, the state of Upekkha. You know, he starts with Maitri, loving kindness. He goes on to Karuna, goes on to Mudita, and he ends up with Upekkha, that perfect calm equanimity, which is not indifference. It is the state of action which is utterly free of all disturbing activity. When we ordinarily meditate or pay attention, our paying attention has a peculiar atmosphere of disturbing activity about the paying attention. This is the effortful meditation that Krishnamurti is constantly criticizing. But you see, he just says effort, giving one the impression that it is any and every kind of effort, but it isn't. There is that other effort which is the effortless effort. No, but do it, it will happen, you know. It will just happen. And it will not happen unconsciously. It won't happen with that kind of effortless ease which marks the concert artist who has got complete mastery over technique, you see. It's not quite that kind of effortless ease. It's a different kind of effortlessness. I can't describe it yet. Said he hopefully that he might describe it someday. You see? But it is effortless. You see, when you experience that, then you will really know once and for all why the Buddha, when he talks of the deep jhanas in meditation, and he enters the first jhana and experiences a sense of ease. Second jhana, he experiences a sense of ease. Third, fourth, 156th jhana, he experiences a sense of ease. And the good, common sense, hard-headed Englishman says, what on earth is this fellow talking about? He hasn't got anything to say, but ease. Let him put it once only at the end and I'll understand. I'm an intelligent fellow after all. But I'm not. One doesn't understand it. This ease. Nirvana is a state of ease. The transcendent is in complete ease. This is the bliss of the transcendent. That is why the transcendent knows neither dukkha nor sukha. But only ka, the infinite, the absolute. You see, this. Oh, there's no one here who started at the beginning. When did you come, Nikki, first? What year?
4 or 5 years ago.
4 or 5 only. George? But those of you, those who came right at the inception of these groups, I used to emphasize that aspect of the work of the religion, which was the purification of the mind and the heart. You see? The purification of the mind and heart. Now this purification is not merely a case of a moral purification only, just a sila's only. It is not a purification of the mind in the sense of getting rid of all false teachings or false views. When we, for example, very solemnly study Buddhism and, oh no, this is a false view, this is incorrect, this is the right view. When we learn it like that, brainfully, we are acquiring another false view. Life after life, we go on working out our karma till we realize nirvana, enlightenment. A false view. The devout Christian says, there is no such nonsense as life after life and all the rest of it. I believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, and the grace of God has cleansed my soul of all my sins. Another false view. So, this purification of the mind, you will experience that pure state when you get this freedom from desire. See, desire in the ontological sense, the universal sense, the total sense. But before that can happen, there is this preliminary stage, isn't there? When one sees, one really sees, not just intellectually, not because you have studied your Upanishads carefully and so forth, that all this, which is just Brahman emanating, that all this is dukkha, is the mortal. You see? When you really see that, and are quite awake to it naturally, you don't have to argue with yourself about it, you see, then the worldly desires cease. They don't die. What happens is, to say that they die is a mistake, is a mistaken way of putting it. What happens is that the psychical energy which flowed into this, that and the other channel, which was a worldly channel, now your psychical energy flows into a different channel. Because you've seen. It's the vision, it's the seeing. This is where the intellectual part is so necessary. You cannot dispense with the intellectual part. All these foolish people who say, oh, I'm not an intellectual, but I have intuition. All that such rubbish. Fiddlesticks intuition. My little cat has more intuition than most of these intuitionists as such.
Little cat?
Well-fed one, the big fellow. Now, when one really sees that, you see, then the psychical energy flows in another way. The Chandogya Upanishad put it beautifully. Talking about the Atma, that great unborn Atma, ageless, sorrowless, thirstless, hungerless, whose conception is satya, the ultimate truth, the ultimate real, you see? We'll just use the word real. Whose conception is the real, whose desire is the real. Desire is the real. The Buddha talks of it. He says, summon up all your passion, your desire, towards treading the path and getting rid of all the defilements of the mind. Doesn't he? He puts it like that. Alright. So whose desire is the real? Now put it in theistic terms. As Islam or Christianity or Zarathustrianism would put it. The love of God, the desire is for God, your whole passion is for God, then it becomes a reality. But it cannot be any reality as long as I have conceptions of God, etc., etc., etc. But when I have seen this, and my psychical energy naturally flows along this line, this channel, which means the liberation into the unconditioned, into the transcendent, then all your electrochemical processes cease to worry you. Otherwise you have your neuroses and complexes and all whatnot, because you have conflicts. Isn't it? This is where our beloved brother Freud made a slight error, you see. Let go. No, you don't let go. You neither hold on nor let go. This is what the world of psychologists and philosophers and so on haven't understood. This freedom from the conflict of the duals. Neither the one nor the other. All you do is stay just where you are. Sit tight. Sit tight very loosely. You see? No. There's no reason why we shouldn't be happy and laughing with transcendental things. But that is the fact. See, just sit tight. And this transformation in consciousness will take place. See, the whole of religion is concerned with this insight thing. The world of religion, the world of the transcendent, emerges out of the out of man's brain. It cannot emerge out of a cat's brain or the sensitive mechanism of a plant or the stone or whatever it is. It cannot. This is where man comes on the scene. This is why the great ones who realized transcendent, realized the transcendence, spoke in these terms. Hermes Trismegistus puts it this way, an all-father mind. So that was interesting, they put it as mind. All-father mind, finally, made man in his own image and fell in love with him. And then man, looking down upon cosmos, desired to go down and tame, I've forgotten now, it's about 4 or 5 years since I looked at it, tame or utilize the fire. And fire is presented in Zarathustrianism as the son of Ahura Mazda. Atar Putro Ahura Mazda. And this fire is the fire with which Christ baptizes, unlike John the Baptist, who only uses water. You'll find something in that chapter. Just a sentence. So you see, the mind becomes pure. Then, when the mind realizes that upekkha, that state of perfect peace and harmony and balance, that state of action which is free of disturbing activity, then the pure mind is there. That is the pure mind. But you see, that's a transcendent thing. It's nothing to do with our worldly things. If people ask us, yes, this is all very wonderful and you may be marvelous in all these transcendental heights, but I am concerned with the things of the world here. How do I tackle this terrible situation, that terrible situation, that terrible situation? How do I solve these problems? How would you solve these problems? I have only one answer to that. I solve the problem by resolving you, the man, or myself, the man. When I have resolved myself, the man, brought him into a state of harmony, then the problems will vanish. It is because you and I are what we are that all the horrible things of the world are there. They will disappear completely. Was it at this group that I said that in this connection we were considering the influences which play upon an infant from the beginning as it grows up?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And only the mind of a Buddha or a Jesus is the type of mind which is fit to be a parent. Yes. You see, mankind will give birth to Buddhas and Christs. when that. It will proceed that way. Not today, tomorrow, next century. Another million years? Au revoir till then.
when you think of many years ago, when life was uncomplicated, it was so much easier for those men to attain enlightenment, wasn't it? Didn't have the struggle for existence they have today, bald-headed persuaders, etc.
George, I think it would not be too easy to... agree with that altogether. In some ways it was easier, but in other ways it was very much more awful. You know, for instance, if you look at the Mahadukkha Khanda Sutta, the great body of Dukkha, Dukkha Khanda, Maha, big, Mahadukkha Khanda Sutta, the Buddha is saying, life is Dukkha. See what happens if you're a robber or something. See what happens to you. And then follows a list of, my God, what happens to you. You know, honestly, the world in which he lived was a hell of a world. Terrible world. It had its own terrors and awful things. Its own particular depravities and insecurities and conflicts and evil. I don't know whether we ever can compare. It's the fashion amongst people to say, no age has, etc., as our present age. In some respects, yes, no age has invented, learned the secret of atomic power and invented atomic bombs and the threat of them and so forth. True enough. But look, if you and I were living 5,000 years ago, the fact that our neighboring tribe had caught hold of a branch of a tree and tied a string at the two ends and made another long piece of stick and could absolutely kill me, I'd be just as terrified of that as I am with an atomic bomb. In fact, less, I think. I'm peculiarly impervious. This is a defect, I think, not a good thing. I'm peculiarly impervious to the threat of atomic weapons. It's so tremendous, so complete, so perfect. But I'm not the least bit unhappy. I'd be much more unhappy if a howling, raging mob suddenly came rushing about, you know. Because then you can be hurt and suffer for a long time. There's an atomic bomb. One magnificent... Up we go, boys.
Mr. Sindler's. Huh? Mr. Sindler's.
Unless, of course, you're on the edge of it. Then, indeed, the most horrible horror. For the persons involved. And I look. Have we seen something really today? Let the eye look and the ear hear, free of the bondage of desire. Desire cannot be extirpated. It cannot be pushed out. It must not be repressed. It must not be directed by the desirous, confused, incapable brain into this, that, or the other channel, saying that this is good. But just watch that desire. Pay attention to it. Whatever its shape it may take. And in that paying attention, you're actually loving the desire. A pure love. When you really love, you pay complete attention to the beloved. You really are lost. You're completely lost. You can't do anything but be wholly attentive to the beloved, if you really are in love. Even at our caste level.